This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
When it's time to go after the biggest buck of your life, you need gear that will not only make your life easier, but that you can also depend on for years to come. Lone Wolf Custom Gear has been the leader in mobile hunting equipment for over 40 years and started out right here in Wisconsin. From inventing the climbing stick to perfecting ultralight tree stands, Lone Wolf Custom Gear continues to innovate and put the best mobile hunting equipment on the market with a ton of fantastic accessories that allow you to customize your gear exactly how you want it. Whether it be the high-end DeQuisto series sticks and stands or the affordable Patriot series, you'll have the peace of mind knowing that you're hanging off of gear that was 100% made in the USA, right here in the Midwest, in fact, and has been designed and perfected by some of the best whitetail hunters in the world. Not to mention, it has an unconditional lifetime warranty that's so good your grandkids and even great-grandkids will be able to use it when they're hunting. Go build your kit out today at lonewolfcustomgear.com.
E-scouting is the crucial first step to any great adventure, but sometimes we gotta swap the muck boots for flip-flops and the shotguns for fishing rods and get out on the water to recharge those batteries. Whether you're in search of the lunker that broke you off last summer or trying to get the family out for a day on the water, you need to have a game plan. That's where Onyx Fish comes into play. With detailed bathymetry maps, expert information, historical fisheries data, and filters that allow you to hone in on your next favorite lake for a multitude of species, this is an angler's best friend. Shoot, I'm actually planning a father-son trip to the Northwoods with some buddies right now, and I already feel like I've got a game plan in place to catch more fish than the rest of those guys. And the best part is, it's easy, intuitive, and based on the same platform as our beloved Onyx Hunt app. Go check it out today and start finding your next honey hole at onyxmaps.com/fish.
Fall is here and it's time to get out in the woods. And when you do, you need gear that's going to keep you warm, dry, and concealed while you're pursuing wild game. That's why I'm proud to be partners with Huntworth Gear, the makers of badass, affordable hunting gear that's readily available and won't break the bank. You've heard me talk about this gear for years now, and for good reason. Their Heat Boost gear is the warmest hunting gear I've ever worn, and guys, I promise you, I'm not just saying that. It beats the heck out of traditional merino, fleece, or down hunting clothes. Not to mention, we've got a ton of great new camo patterns, including our new waterfowl pattern, Oberus, which has been expertly designed to keep you concealed from wary ducks flying overhead. To go get kitted out for this fall, visit huntworthgear.com or head on over to the sporting goods section of your local Farm and Fleet or Fleet Farm to check it out in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies, and one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or you're just looking to try something new and get into fly fishing. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com. If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about on this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them as well. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Wisconsin BHA Chapter was formed to provide a voice for hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy, and everyone involved worked their tails off to protect public lands and access to those public lands and waters. To stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. Also, be on the lookout for our Wisconsin Public Land Policy bonus episodes to keep you all in the loop on the legal side of conservation and how things get done here in Wisconsin. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what's going on here in the Badger State, Visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin.
What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast, which is brought to you by Lone Wolf Custom Gear. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, I hope you're all doing well. I hope you're enjoying spring thus far, or hopefully finally we're going to be into some consistent spring, I'm hoping. I don't know. March is always a crapshoot. I'm sure we've got a little bit more snow in the forecast beyond the 10-day window that we can see thus far. But finally got some rain coming this week. Super fired up about that. At least as I record this, we've got some rain in the forecast because I was out in the trout streams this last week and things were a little low, a little clear. And we had some very opinionated trout that we were dealing with. If it wasn't perfect, they were not in the mood to eat it. So that's part of the fun of it. But it's kind of along the lines of what we're going to be talking about today. I've got Kirk Olson, the inland waters fisheries biologist for the Wisconsin DNR. Kirk, how are we doing today?
Good, good. Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, dude, I'm excited to have you. Sorry, I think we had a little bit of a lag there on my end. That's my bad. I am super stoked for this one. I have been wanting to talk with a driftless fisheries biologist for years now, and I just haven't gotten around to doing it. So I've got a whole lineup of questions for you, as we were just talking about, and I'm excited to pick your brain. And I know folks listening to this are going to be really excited to learn more about kind of the inner workings of our driftless trout streams. We've talked to a handful of guides across the state and across the driftless who spend their time in the driftless, and we've talked quite a bit about different strategies and fly presentations and all sorts of stuff. We haven't actually talked about the streams, the fish, and the actual biology of it, so I'm super excited. To kick things off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of just who you are, where you're from, what you do for the DNR, and sort of the area and watersheds that you oversee?
Yeah. So I'm Kirk Olson, senior fisheries biologist here in La Crosse. I cover the waters in Monroe, Vernon, La Crosse, and Crawford counties. So kind of right in the heart of the driftless area. Basically everything that isn't the Mississippi River. So yeah, there's a separate crew that covers the Mississippi. So I'm pretty much focused on trout stuff. There's a handful of small man-made impoundments in my area, but the majority of our work is trout stream work. So I'm you know, grew up big interest in trout fishing, and so it fits perfectly with what I really enjoy doing and my professional background too. So
awesome. Yeah, that definitely is a good fit, especially when you can take that passion and line it up in a way that gets you a paycheck at the end of the week, too. That's awesome. Sure. How long have you been the fisheries biologist for these counties?
Yeah. I think I started here in 2017. So coming up on 9 years here in spring, I guess, in a month or so. And I've been here for a little while now. Before that, I worked for the DNR up in up north in Superior and Bayfield and Brule, and working on all sorts of different projects as a limited term fisheries biologist up there. And it was 2017 started here. So
very nice. Were you working on trout waters up north there as well?
Yep. Yeah, I worked on the Brule, worked on the White River up there in Ashland, Bayfield counties, and with the biologists up there and kind of helping them pull their data together and write reports, and did a little bit of work on walleye in Lake Superior too. Most of my other work has been with salmonids, but that was a fun project too. So
totally. That's awesome, man. And cool to be able to get that experience working with trout in such a different environment compared to what the driftless is. And like we've talked about it before on the show, how Wisconsin's kind of a training ground for whatever fish species you want to target outside the state. And, you know, if you're doing the migratory fish thing. You know, we've got some waters that you can play with that. If you're going to go do high mountain, you know, super skinny kind of creeks, we've got the Driftless. If you want to go do the Hex thing, you're going to hop over the lake to Michigan, we've got the Central region and all that. Mm-hmm. Like, we're spoiled rotten with how many different sort of little, I guess, what would the prop, like, I guess, different habitats, different regions, different, like.
Yeah. I mean, kind of different opportunities. And, you know, there's, yeah, like you say, the migratory forms that we have in the Great Lakes. Yeah, on the Brule River alone, you know, that's kind of a unique place. You've got resident brook and brown trout. You've got migratory, you know, coho salmon and steelhead. And then you got resident rainbow trout. So there's just such variety and different types of fishing, you know, you need to understand or know how to do to catch those fish or target those different I guess life history variants in that river. So yeah, and I mean, yeah, there's just so much diversity and opportunity in Wisconsin, you know, considering we don't have, you know, we've got the Great Lakes, but we don't have, like, you know, an ocean shoreline or anything like that. Right. The diversity is pretty amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Sure. Definitely. So obviously being in the Driftless, you guys oversee a ton in all the different trout streams. I mean, we're spoiled rotten with how many. I don't envy you in trying to keep track of all those trout streams and maintain data on that and try and get to all those different spots, because there are so many different creeks in the Driftless. What are some of the projects that you and your team do on these trout streams? What are some of the things that, like, you guys focus on? Is it surveys? Is it restoration work, water sampling? Like, what all goes into your role? And what are the things that you guys are looking at?
Yeah, kind of all those things. So yeah, we basically are, you know, we do our surveys every year. We do, you know, roughly 100 sites on trout streams. We've got about 36 where we sample them annually, and those are kind of on our most popular, highest priority waters, like Timber Coulee, North Fork Bad Axe, and Brush Creek, Plum Creek, these streams with really, you know, high quality populations and lots of angling. And that kind of annual data gives us an indication of, you know, kind of how populations are changing over time with changes in weather patterns and whatnot. We also use that data for evaluating, like, regulations and habitat changes too. But on top of that, we have, oh gosh, another like 40 to 60 sites that we do each year. We rotate in all the watersheds in the four counties that we cover. We're on about an 8 to 9 year rotation where we try to hit each water in those four counties at least once every 9 years. And so we focus in on a watershed, we survey all the streams, and we, you know, pull all the data, and then we go back in our, you know, historical records, and we see how things compare to the past, and see how, you know, what we're doing, if, you know, if it's stocking or regulations or habitat, try to see how that is all doing. And then we make recommendations from that. So basically, you know, all the sampling that we do every summer kind of drives all the other stuff that we do. So, you know, we get do those 100 sites, and then in the winter we pull our data together and kind of see how what we've done in the past is working and what maybe we should do instead or how we should change things. So, yeah, you know, in terms of other work, you know, we develop and kind of plan our habitat projects. So based on the information we have, you know, where would a habitat project be beneficial, or where do we need to look at pursuing, you know, purchasing stream bank easements, or, you know, land purchase opportunities, or, you know, for public access and habitat. Otherwise, of course, like I mentioned, stocking. So we don't have to do as much stocking. And as I've been here in the past 9 years, we've been able to slowly dial our stocking back further and further. But yeah, we've been able to do that, and based on the information that we collect, it helps us understand, well, you know, shoot, we're running natural reproduction in a population that's sustained at like 2,000 fish per mile. We don't need to put any fish in there. So, so stocking, regulation changes too, you know, those have been relatively stable since I've been here, but we made some small tweaks here and there. As you know, one of the things that have come up has been, we've seen some brook trout decline. So we have a regulation where brook trout is catch and release, but brown trout, you can, you know, harvest up to five fish. So those types of things, you know, we, so yeah, regulation, stocking, habitat. We also do a good amount of outreach too every year. So with different school groups, gosh, we must do, you know, maybe like 8 to 10 demos every year. We go and do electrofishing demonstrations, get the kids all excited and shock some fish and show them. And yeah, it's always a lot of fun. But yeah. And then otherwise, on top of that, I try to fit in some special projects. If there's like, you know, a question that comes up as we're, you know, doing our surveys or doing the work that we do, and we don't have, you know, answers from the literature or from, you know, our research scientists, and it's a manageable project, we try to take those on and answer those questions on our own too. So, yeah, we've done a couple over the years, you know, most recently looking at brook trout and brown trout interactions. And so, yeah, it's a fun job. There's always something different. There could be three of me, I think, and we would still be busy because, yeah, there's a lot of water and just a huge trout resource in these four counties. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What is the key, I guess, when you guys are going into these properties and stuff, what is like typically the main method of like assessing things? Are you guys going in and electrofishing a stretch? Are you guys going in, I'm assuming you're taking water samples as you're doing that maybe, or like what does that sort of check-in process look like for you guys?
Yeah. So we've got kind of a standard sampling method that we follow, that everyone in the state follows, and for surveying trouts, wadeable trout streams in the state. So yeah, it really, the biggest piece of information is the fish data, because I mean that really reflects what's going. I mean, that's the main piece that we're looking at, you know, what we want to know. But on top of that, we do collect, you know, so we do our electrofishing survey. So like, you know, for those of you who aren't familiar, like basically we use electricity to temporarily incapacitate the fish and allows us to scoop them up. We put them in a tub with some water, let them recover. We measure, weigh, sometimes tag, check for parasites, all that sort of thing. And that all gets recorded and we use a tablet now that goes directly into our statewide database. So all the data we collect, you know, we can use it, but then also, you know, folks who are looking at statewide trends, they can pull our data too. But at any rate, so, you know, we do our electrofishing surveys. We collect some basic water quality parameters over there, like the discharge of the stream, water clarity, dissolved oxygen levels, and conductivity and pH, just kind of basic water quality parameters that we collect to kind of help us get a picture of streams in our four counties and kind of understand how they're operating and their general health. So yeah,
sure. What is like ideal conditions? Like if you were going to do like a water sample, mm-hmm. like does it vary from stream to stream? Maybe, or like, what do you guys look for?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there are these basic water quality parameters that we collect. They vary quite a bit among the streams in our counties. But for trout, you know, we want to see dissolved oxygen levels over 6 milligrams per liter. I mean, when we rarely see anything lower than that. I mean, usually it's more like 7 up to even super saturated in some of these streams where you have open canopy and lots of aquatic vegetation and lots of nutrients, like some of our timber coulees and whatnot. We, you know, you run a dissolved oxygen in summer and it's super saturated. It's like, you know, 14, 15 milligrams per liter, which is above the 100% oxygen saturation for that system. But otherwise, you know, the pH and the conductivity, those are kind of just giving us an indication of, really, they mostly reflect the bedrock geology. If there's, you know, some sort of issue with runoff or something like that, they might give us some, if it's extraordinarily high, it could give us an indication that something is going on and we should investigate it further. But usually, the variation that we see is due to the difference in bedrock geology that we have in the four counties. So like north of I-90, mostly sandstone bedrock. You know, if you, the first rock that you hit is kind of more this sandstone. It doesn't, you know, doesn't have, or when it's eroded, doesn't result in all these ions ending up in the water, like you'd have with your dolostone or your limestone bedrock that you have kind of south of I-90 in Vernon, Crawford counties, and southern portion of La Crosse. So the conductivities in those waters are often much higher than those in the north. It's interesting that the two streams, you know, divided by that kind of I-90 line, or the streams north of there are very different, kind of the stream shape, the kind of more stained waters, lower productivity, lower trout numbers, just naturally. And then as you get to the south into that kind of dolostone, limestone, bedrock geology, those streams can be extremely productive, and where we get our, 1,000 to sometimes 4,000, 5,000 adult fish per mile, so.
Crazy.
Yeah.
It's wild. So you mentioned the conductivity there, that mm-hmm. has to do with the type of stone that is mm-hmm. basically lining the stream bed.
Yeah. Yep. So that's, the gravels and stuff that are all, mm-hmm. Those are all eroded from those bluffs and the bedrock that's, in that watershed. And those, eventually, break down over time, and, the ions are released into the water. So calcium carbonate, from your limestones mm-hmm. and whatnot. So that increases the conductivity. So, any dissolved ion in the water would increase conductivity. So if you were to see a really, really high reading, it could be because of agricultural runoff too, outside of the standard. Yep. But generally when we're sampling our streams, it's an indication of what the bedrock geology is like.
Yeah. On that note of runoff and stuff, mm-hmm. say you do have I feel like most time when we're thinking about trout streams, runoff is looked at in a negative connotation. But if you do have that where it runs off and it increases the conductivity, is that potentially beneficial to the stream, or is it still more so you'd rather have it naturally through the rock?
Yeah. I mean, excess nutrients entering the system is bad.
Right.
We've got plenty of natural productivity in these stream systems where, additional runoff from, say, farm fields, manure, that sort of thing, is generally not a good thing. You can have, basically it cooks and, you get the material settling out in the bottom of the stream, and that bacteria and will break it down and use up the dissolved oxygen, and then you don't have oxygen for trout. Otherwise, if we, you might have runoff that happens in the spring, and if there's not a lot of, say, organic material, manure, particulate, that sort of thing that runs into the stream, it may be dirty looking, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's rich in, organics, and it's going to drive the dissolved oxygen down. In fact, when you get a lot of runoff, or rainfall event, often your conductivity can be lower because you've got, a lot of basically dilution, a lot of dilution. So, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Makes sense. I mm-hmm. figured, usually it's no good, but, so I guess what kind of what makes you guys decide, when looking at a project? It sounded like earlier when you mentioned, it has to do with what are the most high trafficked waterways that kind of determine when you make those rounds and everything. But when it comes to actually doing the restoration side of things and mm-hmm. rebuilding banks, looking at erosion and stuff like that, at what point do you guys start looking at it and think, okay, I'm going to step in and mm-hmm. we need to address this ASAP?
Yeah. So that's a good question. And, the first step is identifying that needs to be done. So we try to use the data that we collect, from our surveys to guide, where do we need to do habitat work? Where are the population? Where do we see adult abundances that are, not really occupying what could be there? Where do we see potential for improvement by doing the habitat project, And so that's kind of a big step, figuring that out. And so, we kind of use our data to do that. But then the other big pieces of the puzzle, especially now, we kind of, we have less staff and time and funds to do work. Other big pieces of the puzzle can be, well, one, all the work that we do has to be on public access lands where there's perpetual public access. So we purchase stream bank easements currently. So perpetual stream bank easements we can purchase if the landowner is willing. Otherwise, if there's, you know, state owned land or like another like county easement where it's perpetual, then that type of thing we could do work on. Yeah. But then it's partners. The big thing is partners having, you know, people help with putting together a plan, a design. You know, we work closely with them, but, you know, we're a, you know, short, lack of time, lack of staff, lack of funds. So we try to find those projects where we can get help and where there's people are excited about helping make something happen and can help reduce the costs and reduce our time having to put together projects. So yeah, kind of a lot of different pieces that we, you know, basically come together for us to have time and, you know, money and et cetera to make a project happen. Yeah,
for sure. When purchasing those easements, is that done with like Knowles Nelson funding?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Typically? Okay.
Yep. Yeah. So that's all done with Knowles Nelson. Yeah. So that's been a really enjoyable part of my job since I've been here. It's not something I had an opportunity to do in the past. And like being able to, you know, go talk to landowners, tell them about what we do and get them excited. And, you know, then we have funding, you know, we had funding to, or have funding to purchase these easements in perpetuity. It's like, all right, this is something I can do that's going to stick, you know? So it's been a really a very special program for sure.
Totally. You mentioned too, bringing in some other organizations, I'm assuming, like I know mm-hmm. Trout Unlimited helps out with a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at the gazetteer and you can see, or the map of improved trout waters, whatever. And there's all the like TU project mm-hmm. dates and easements and stuff. What does the relationship look like working with them, and how do you guys kind of determine who does what?
Yeah. So Trout Unlimited is a huge partner for sure. We have local chapters that we work with, and then there's the Driftless Area Restoration Initiative through Chartered Limited as well. And so they've got staff that have helped with a lot of different projects. But, you know, for like example, got different projects. We're looking to line up on the West Fork Kickapoo River where, you know, the Chartered Limited DARE staff, they're able to help move things along in terms of the permitting end of things, the floodplain zoning, getting the design together. And oftentimes, you know, what we do is, you know, they're able to kind of help with that end of things. And then we can provide our, you know, we have a habitat crew. It's kind of limited in what we can do because we've got a big area to cover, but we've got a crew. And so, you know, they can cover that end, then we can come in and, you know, do the actual work based on the plans that they were able to put together and all that legwork. So that can work out really well. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, the local chapters, we got a local chapter here, the Cooley TU.
Yeah.
And they've been really, you know, they're really great to work with too. And volunteering on, you know, electrofishing days. And we're also, it's like a common theme, short staff, but we basically been operating with, you know, like two, so myself, another fisheries biologist, and a half-time LTE. And, you know, we pretty much needed three-person crew to do a lot of our sampling. So they've been a big help, you know. Different folks have come out and helped us from that chapter during our surveys. And we've done some tree planting too, trying to get some shade trees in certain areas established, thinking about air temperatures increasing in the future. So yeah. I mean, TU's definitely been a big help with the work that we do and the habitat restoration work we do on the streams. It's, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've got Mike's contact info sitting here that I'm hoping to get him on later this spring to kind of talk about their side of the, you know, just their work and what they're doing across the state and everything there as well. So
nice.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear that they're a great partner and able to help kind of lighten the load a little bit for you guys, and especially help out with, you know, the electrofishing and stuff like that. I mean, I had buddies in college down at Platteville who had interned with them, and then shock a stream and send me pictures of all these fish they pulled out that day, and we'd go there that night and be like, oh, we gotta fire. Like, we know it's good now. And
yeah.
Get our butts kicked, and that was that. But
that's it's always humbling when you do electrofishing survey on these streams. It's like, how is it possible that there are these fish? I mean, you even walk the banks and it's like, okay, you see a few fish darting around, but once you stick mm-hmm. the electricity in there, it's it's just stunning how many trout can be in these little streams. And then you go fish it and it's like, okay, I catch five, which is, you know, fun, but I know there's 150 in this, you know, 200 yard reach, but it's wild.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to circle back to the electrofishing stuff in a bit there, but on the note of like restoration work and everything, you mentioned kind of the warming air temperature trend and everything. Are there any other trends that you guys are seeing on these trout streams that you guys are trying to kind of prepare for?
Hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick sec to tell you about Lone Wolf Custom Gear. Lone Wolf Custom Gear is as good as it gets when it comes to mobile hunting equipment. Whether you're a saddle or stand guy, public land or private, Lone Wolf Custom Gear has a set of sticks, a stand, a camera arm, and any number of accessories to get you closer to your target buck. To make it even better, everything is 100% USA sourced and made right here in the Midwest. And it's even assembled right across the river in Iowa by hunters who love chasing deer just as much as you do. To build your kit today, go visit lonewolfcustomgear.com. Now, let's get back to the episode.
Yeah, no, I mean, the air temperature thing's a big one right now. So, you know, we've seen average annual air temperatures in the area, you know, not even just projected increase. The data's already shown it's increasing. So it's already happening. On top of that, we've got average annual increases in precipitation as well, which is maybe a good thing in some ways and a bad thing in other ways. So, you know, with increasing air temperatures, that's obviously a big concern because trout need cold water to survive, right? So our, you know, brook trout, brown trout, when water temps are, you know, reaching up into the 70s, they're getting stressed. And once it gets close to 80, they're pretty much dying. So we need those cool temperatures. And when air temperature increases, well, the water temperature follows suit. With climate change and this increase in air temperature and coupled with the increase in precipitation, one of the kind of positives, I guess, we've seen is that despite air temperature increasing, our base flows over a longer period have been increasing. So when I say base flow, I mean the amount of groundwater coming into a stream. So although air temperatures are increasing, our water temperatures have been relatively stable on these driftless streams so far, which is, you know, a big relief. They seem to be, you know, somewhat resilient to this increase in air temp because we seem to be getting more precipitation reaching the groundwater and feeding these streams. So yeah, like, I mean, if you look at, there's some long-term data, like in the Coon Creek watershed, where they've got groundwater monitoring wells that go back to the 20s or 30s. It's wild. And so you can see the increase in the groundwater level from then to now is just, it's stunning. But even in the past 25 years, the level of increase in groundwater level is noticeable, and it's, you know, it's gone up a good amount. So this is hopefully helping buffer some of those air temperature increases. If that will persist, you know, I don't know, but that's been one kind of good sign, at least for the driftless in terms of climate change. But yeah, in terms of what we're doing, you know, thinking about air temperature increases in the future, so we had a big push to try to do some more sort of targeted tree planting to create shade. Of course, you know, shaded streams are not warming as quickly as open canopy streams. So we're trying to find places where we can create shade that where we'll have an impact. And so we're trying to do it in a sort of targeted way, finding these open canopy reaches with the right sort of orientation. So, you know, we're actually and planting on the, you know, south side of the bank and trying to think about it a little bit as we're doing these plantings. We're also thinking about angler access as we're doing these plantings, because we don't want to create a situation where we make a big shrubby stream that nobody can fish. And well, what, you know, our job is to, you know, make fishing better. So another thing we're, you know, as we're doing this, we're considering the trees we're planting and, you know, like swamp white oak and maybe some cottonwoods for some shade in the earlier stages, but also maintaining vegetation in the future, you know, as things grow up, using, you know, our fecon, you know, doing some brushing to make sure we still have angler access as we're getting more shade, you know, kind of hoping for more of a savanna type situation, you know, where we've got open understory where it's easy to walk and fish. but this canopy that can help to shade things. So, and it might be, it's going to definitely take some work, but yeah, I think it'll hopefully help things out. But
yeah,
otherwise, other trends, you know, again, with climate change, we've seen those big floods happening in recent years. Mm-hmm. So we've had a couple of 500-year, you know, flood events in the past 20, 30 years. So, you know, one was like 2008, another one in 2018, like 10 years apart. And that 2018 one was pretty bad. It hit a lot of the habitat work that had been done in the past in the Coon Creek watershed, North Fork, the Bad Axe, the West Fork Kickapoo. So some of our premier waters, some of the old habitat work that had been done got damaged pretty bad. Certain areas held up well, but certain areas really got hit hard. And so, you know, that's a big concern if we continue to see, you know, fortunately since that 2018 flood, we haven't had anything massive. So like a lot of these streams have been able to recover even in places where we haven't been able to go in and do habitat work. Where just vegetation grows up on the banks, stabilizes things. The stream kind of will narrow on its own naturally as long as there aren't any major floods. And then the habitat begins to improve again. You get your riffle pool run instead of a big wide flat that was blasted out during a flood. So yep. Fortunately, we've, since 2018, it's been pretty stable. So a lot of that habitat has improved quite a bit. But yeah, those floods are pretty rough. And so hopefully we don't see any of those in the near future, but you know, it's likely that we will. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How much variance do you see, I guess, in, say there's a stretch of creek or river that has more of like that kind of savanna, like you were talking about, those prairie grasses, deep root systems, kind of that buffer around the water. How much better do you see those hold up and even like maintain cooler temperatures as opposed to areas where there's cropland or maybe it's all trees or whatever it may be?
Quite a bit better. So like during that 2018 flood, we had, you know, I in the Coon Creek watershed, which is kind of our crown jewel, the four counties, long history there, lots of habitat work and easement and lands. I walked many miles of stream after that flood, just kind of documenting the extent of the impact and where, you know, we might have to do work in the future. And there were definitely patterns, places where there was thick, you know, ungrazed kind of savanna type situation. You had thick vegetation and some trees mixed in. Those places did really well. Also places where there's a good floodplain connection, you know, that's key too. Places that really got hit were heavily, I'd say moderately to heavily grazed. You know, those banks, the vegetation just didn't hold the banks as well. Otherwise, you know, some of those box elder forested reaches too, those are, you know, pretty weakly rooted trees and the banks, but also the banks in combination with high banks, usually where those box elder are growing, had a lot of changes in the stream there. But yeah, it seemed like those areas where you had better buffers, better, you know, vegetation growing, they really held up. You know, I mean, there were some places like, our property on the lower end of Timber Cooley, we have state property there. It's kind of what we're describing, the savanna, you know, prairie plants and some trees and willows a little bit mixed in, but that it was like, there wasn't a single thing damaged. It looked fine. Other places as we went upstream, you know, they're, you know, maybe heavily grazed or moderately grazed pasture, and those banks really got hit. Yep.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Do you see much temperature variance in those, like, deep, you know, the more savanna buffery? Obviously it has to do with like how close are you to a spring head, how far up in the system are you and stuff. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't know. I'm only asking because I had a guy who's up in your neck of the woods who does whitetail property management. Oh. He had a client who was inquiring about whether or not that prairie grass made that big of a difference on the temperature front with waters, which I thought maybe it would with the taller grasses as they kind of shade shade half the creek. But I wasn't sure if you guys had any data on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have a little bit of data that's kind of related on some of our habitat projects. where, yeah, I mean, having a more open canopy, that stream will warm more rapidly. And I can also say, you know, we put out temperature loggers, at least a dozen on every watershed we do. And you can kind of see, I mean, of course, there's springs and stuff. You know, there's a lot of thermal variation, right, as you have different spring inputs and whatnot. But just a general pattern seems to be those really wide open canopy without much thick vegetation. Those seem to warm up quicker than, sure, those where you've got, you know, either trees or you've got, you know, mix of savanna type situation like you're talking about with prairie grasses and narrower stream channel and that sort of thing. So, sure, yeah, not super solid data, but, you know, kind of, and, you know, what I've seen, you know, just with our temperature data seems to, yeah, point that direction. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Canopy, yep, and, yeah, I'm sure how makes closely it hugs the whatever bluff or hillside or ridge, right, or whatever, and how much shade it can get throughout the day. I'm sure that plays.
Yeah, there's a lot of variables once you start. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. On the note of trends there, we've obviously had a pretty large increase in angler numbers in the last 5 years or so. Have you guys seen any real impacts from that increased fishing, higher fish mortality, variances in, you know, where fish are in a system? Like, do you see them kind of push up or down through a system that might be easemented versus non-easemented? Higher erosion, I don't know. What kind of stuff, yeah, are you guys seeing there?
Yeah, no, good question. You know, when you look at like our Wisconsin trout stamp sales, they're relatively stable. But, mm-hmm, I think there is something to your point, because we don't necessarily have area specific trout stamp sale numbers. And I tend to think, you know, based on my observations and just in the time I've been here, that, yeah, since COVID, there's been a big uptick in pressure. So,
yeah,
just thinking personally, spots I would, you know, fish in the past, they'd be for sure spots I knew I could go out and fish on my own. I'd go out, oh, somebody's fishing here, I guess the next spot. All right. But yeah, no, in terms of the impacts on, you know, with more pressure on some of these streams, potential impacts, not really seeing, you know, the fish are still there. We're not seeing, you know, declines in fish numbers or anything from our trend surveys, you know, that where we survey annually our most popular streams. If anything, trout densities have increased on some streams or remain stable on others. Yeah, so I mean, maybe one thing that might, you know, this is just kind of speculating, but catchability may be affected, as, you know, mm-hmm, you have more anglers having, you know, just based on my personal angling experience, you know, the areas where you've got a lot of pressure, those fish seem to be smarter, you know, so, yep, they, you know, although they're still there, man, they can be really difficult to catch, especially when they're getting fished every day. And then, yeah, like I say, you get upstream, maybe you're walking in the stream off easement and you find a pool and all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow, these fish are dumb. This is great. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's probably something to that. But in terms of actual fish population densities, as there's been more, you know, pressure on certain streams, we haven't seen any, you know, declines in population numbers. I think a big part of that is the prevalence of, you know, catch and release. So most people fishing, there's a, you know, high percentage. We've done some creel surveys too, and it's, you know, gosh, if it's like up in the 70s, 80% that are, you know, doing catch and release pretty much exclusively. So, sure, there's not a lot of harvest. There's not as much harvest as there could be if people decided to.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, on that note too, this will be the first year that we open the harvest season a month earlier on, mm-hmm, April 1st, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yep.
Do you expect to see a whole lot of increase, like, aside from, I personally, I don't think it's going to make a whole lot of a difference, but I'd be curious, yeah, what your thoughts are.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a statewide opener first Saturday in April this year. And yeah, it'll be interesting. I think I'm going to run out and do a quick creel survey where I've done one in the past, just to see how things compare to the opener on, you know, the typical May opener in the past years. But yeah, I don't think, you know, in terms of population numbers, I'm not really, you know, we don't have any concerns in terms of, you know, potential increases in harvest on the streams that I cover, with densities being so high, populations being relatively stable. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the ideas behind expanding it too was to kind of increase opportunities for people to go out and fish and get people excited about trout fishing. So with, you know, the current opener, and if you're up north, it overlaps with, you know, you got to decide, you know, for some people who are just opening weekend anglers, and you got to decide, all right, am I going to go walleye fishing or am I going to go trout fishing? You know, that where I grew up, northern Wisconsin, that was often a thing. So I think one of the ideas behind it was kind of give trout fishing its own opener and get people excited about getting out and, and enjoying the resource. So, but yeah, in terms of impacts here on the streams I cover, there's no indication that we'll see any negative impacts from on populations and from this, from potential increases in harvest.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. What role, if any, like in your guys' research, do anglers, guides, you mentioned like the creel surveys and stuff there, like what, I guess, how much are you looking at like the general angling population, maybe be fly shops or bait and tackle shops and stuff when it comes to the trout stuff? Like, are you guys gathering any data from them?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So we've done some creel surveys in the past. So creel survey is, you know, like what you probably expect that it is. You know, we have a couple staff that go out and interview anglers and count cars and figure out how much pressure there is and how many fish are getting harvested. And so we've done a couple of those over the years since I've been here. So that's our main way of getting information on angler use and pressure and harvest. And on top of those, you know, in addition to those creel surveys, while we're out there with the ones that I've done, we also ask if, you know, the people we survey are willing to do kind of an optional questionnaire. And so we've got some additional questions with more in-depth about, you know, kind of how their feelings are towards the different opportunity and regulation opportunities and habitat and all those sorts of things. Any question that we think will be valuable to be answered. But yeah, in terms of, you know, information from guides and whatnot, I'd say it's mostly just when we have a chance to, when I run into a guide or, you know, stop in the fly shop and chat, that's mostly how we, or sometimes corresponding through emails, that's mostly how we exchange information and get a feel for, you know, what they're seeing. And guides and avid anglers. I mean, I'm in touch with that, you know, people who fish a lot, you know, they're always out there and making observations. Maybe there's things that have come up on an easement or issues with habitat, and they're always in touch with me too. So, you know, that the information they provide can be really valuable sometimes, you know, with knowing what's going on out there. So, yeah, I think there's always opportunities to do more. It's just, people who are out there a lot, they can really, you know, have insights that we can't, you know, it's a big area.
Yeah, definitely. on the note of trends, are there any like aquatic insect trends that you guys are seeing, like increases, decreases of various species or anything like that? Like, is there anything that you guys are seeing on the food side of things?
Yeah. You know, we don't do a lot of, in terms of fisheries specifically, we don't do any invertebrate sampling. There is a separate branch within the DNR that does water quality sampling. And so they sample invertebrates as part of that. I haven't heard from them that there have been any trends in the data that they've collected. I have heard a lot of anecdotes over the, you know, since I've been here in La Crosse, though, from anglers that they've seen declines in hatches. Well, when I first was here, it seemed like there was big declines in hatches, at least based on what anglers were seeing, and like mayfly, caddisfly hatches. And then maybe these floods kind of made that worse. But then some anglers I've heard recently saying, you know, the hatches have been a little better, maybe as, you know, we've gotten further away from those really bad floods. But then other people, you know, it's, so yeah, not to answer your question, we don't have great data, at least, you know, fisheries doesn't, and I haven't seen any trends in the data from water quality in terms of those. But anglers, yeah, certainly I've heard a lot of different observations from them.
I'm right there with you. It's all been anecdotal, and I personally haven't seen a whole lot of change. I mean, maybe a little bit, but it's anything. It almost seems, kind of circling back to like the climate change side of things, mm-hmm. you get more sunny days, the hatches in general are going to kind of be a little bit lower. But I've seen less like total banner day, like all day great hatch. Mm-hmm. Like it was just, you couldn't keep the fish away from them. Mm-hmm. And more so it's like, oh, here's a giant cloud that rolls through and it like pops off this little 5 minute micro hatch. Yeah. And then after that, it like shuts back down. It's like, okay, great. We'll just wait for the next cloud, I guess. And
yeah, right.
You know, so I think that's, but I have like ran into a handful of folks all over the place, mm-hmm. like around the driftless, who are like, well, the bugs don't hatch like they used to. There's too much runoff. Yeah. There's too many chemicals. There's too many whichever. I always thought like, I mean, it makes sense if you're putting pesticides mm-hmm. on the ground that it would make its way into the watershed. I mean, mm-hmm. just about everything does, but I wasn't sure if there was actual data on that or not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there may be, you know, mm-hmm. stuff that I'm just not familiar with. I know there's a lot of work going on in some of the pesticide realm, but just in terms of my personal observations too, like you're saying, I do remember, well, I mean, it's always when you're out there fishing. Now I have a 3-year-old, so I don't get out fishing nearly as much as I used to, but I remember some just amazing caddisfly hatches fishing when I first moved here, and I haven't hit one quite as good as those first couple of years since then, but mm-hmm. you know, it's those in memory too, you know.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Was it actually that thick, or was it just everything was clicking? It was perfect. Right. Yeah. Yeah, totally. You know, we've talked a lot about flooding and, you know, a lot of, you know, high water volume kind of having its way with the stream bed, with erosion and stuff like that. Is there much fish kill during those crazy high water events?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I get a lot of people do ask about that too. And it's, mm-hmm. it is amazing, like, you know, after these massive floods, how few fish die. But yes, we do see some fish, you know, so you often hear like, oh, they're out, you know, they're dead out in the cornfield. And that does happen for sure. Mm-hmm. Like we've seen it, you know, where you get a big flash flood and there's some dead brown trout out in the cornfield or whatever. But the vast majority of fish seem to be able to hunker down and just make it through those floods. So like, for example, that 2018 flood where, you know, it hit the Coon Creek system with like 12 inches of rain in late August, early September. We had just done a survey before that flood on Timber Cooley Creek, and it was just, you know, smoked by that flood. Yep. And we came back, you know, after water levels eventually went back down and resurveyed it. And it was like, yeah, we saw a little decline in the numbers of young of the year. You know, the smaller, you know, mm-hmm. about 3.5 to 4 inches. But the adult population was pretty much the same. So it's just, they must just be able to find, you know, areas near the bottom of the stream where the velocity isn't as high, and they make it through. So it's amazing.
Right. Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Is like, have you guys pinpointed like through shocking or anything? If you have shocked, obviously there's the safety component into that. But like, have you figured out through electrofishing like mm-hmm. where they go, or they just tuck? I mean, I right there with you. I assume they just glued to the bottom and, you know, found somewhere that all that fast water can run over their heads, and they just waited out. But
I don't know of anyone that's tried to look at that. But it's such a challenge to try to sample in those conditions. But just speculating, you would think they must be finding spots where there's a, you know, tucking behind a, you know, a root, tree root, or, you know, where you just near the bottom, you got a boulder, little lower velocities down there. So,
For sure. Mm-hmm. On the note of, I remembered my question. On the note mm-hmm. of stream bank, or not stream bank, but just like general habitat quality, mm-hmm. is there very much variance between the public access stuff? Obviously you guys are able to do more restoration work and have mm-hmm. an actual like physical impact on it. But do you tend to see much variance in, I mean, you mentioned too, like fish, just the amount of pressure and how smart they are on mm-hmm. public waters versus, you know, the stream bed's public, but it's a non-easemented section of stream. Right. Are there any other major differences that you guys tend to see when surveying, for lack of a better term, the private stretches mm-hmm. of our streams? Like, do you tend to see a higher density? Do you tend to see higher quality? Anything like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't say that I've you know, just being out there on the surveys, that I've noticed any substantial difference. You know, one thing I would say is where we have, you know, really good intact habitat work, you can have just astronomical adult trout densities that you might not see on a stretch that's not quite, that doesn't have quite as much habitat diversity. But yeah, it's hard to say because, gosh, I've done surveys where there's not habitat work on, you know, certain streams and, you know, private banks or whatever. And just numbers are off the charts too. So yeah, it's sure. No real substantial pattern that I can think of, you know, besides maybe angling, you know, thinking, walking the stream. And yeah, sometimes you get away from an easement, you're staying in the stream, and all of a sudden the fishing gets better. You know, not as many people walking up there. So
right. Yeah. You find that one big plunge pool and happens to hold a bunch of different fish. But I like what you said there too about the restoration work and the features that you guys are putting in, being kind of a more adult trout magnet, and like the amount of adults that will gravitate towards the whether it be like the lunker structure tucked into the banks, or the, you know, the root wads and stuff that are tucked in there, and everything. That's definitely encouraging, good for folks to know. On that note, when it comes to adult trout, some of our larger trout and everything, I have to ask, through all of your electro surveys in the drift list, what is the largest brown trout that you've caught?
That's a good question. I just around 25, 26, somewhere in there.
Gross. That's awesome.
Yeah, we've had a couple right in that range. Nothing over 26 for sure, but in that 25 to 26 inch range, we've had a couple for sure.
Sure.
But just different creatures when they get that big, those browns.
Definitely. What was the, like, what type of water was it? Are we talking like bigger water? Was it surprisingly narrow? Like, when folks start thinking, going into big fish brain here a little bit, like, what are some of the commonalities you see, or the common traits that you see with these larger fish?
So in terms of like big fish water, usually, I'd say typically it's kind of those, you get to the lower ends of the systems. Sometimes it might even be seasonally utilized by trout, where it actually gets too warm in the late summer and they're not even in there. But yeah, usually these lower portions of the system where, you know, the forage is there, there's lots of warm water. You know, as you get in from cold water down to more warm water conditions, you get a lot more different forage variety in terms of, you know, your dace and your creek chubs and your shiners and crayfish. So those tend to be the places we see those bigger trout. With that said, we still do see big trout on those, you know, kind of upper reaches, you know, those, you know, kind of middle upper reaches with the cold water and mostly trout and some sculpin and stuff. Every once in a while, you'll be shocking a pool, and it's, you know, kind of your typical standards. You know, okay, you get a whole bunch of, you know, 9 to 12 inches, maybe a few 14s and a 15 or whatever, and then all of a sudden, like, there's a 22 or something up there. You know, so every once in a while, there's giants up there too. But I'd say on the whole, probably it's more that kind of bigger water, kind of more marginal. I guess I've seen it too on kind of a medium sized stream that didn't have as much cold water coming in, where it transitioned to that kind of more marginal, is catching, you know, we're catching creek chubs and whatnot, and then finding some big trout in this more medium sized water. But it was, you know, more marginal thermally for trout, seems to be where those bigger fish tend to be.
Sure. Yeah. You know? No, that's okay. I'm glad my theory held true. I was out I was out on Friday. I was kind of prospecting one of these lower stretches of a creek and everything, where it flows into a little bit bigger water. Because I kind of thought, like, I bet they pushed down looking for bigger food, and I hooked a fish, but I only saw basically the bottom of its jaw, and I thought, based on like the gill flare, I was like, oh, that's kind of funky. It looked like a smallmouth. Like, I'll take a smallmouth in February. That's cool. Whatever. And I threw it back in there. My next cast, I mean, it ate a fly that was half its size, but I caught like a 10-inch trout.
On
that. And I was like, oh my God, that wasn't a smallmouth. That sucks.
That hurts.
When they do move up, so going from those lower stretches and stuff, is it primarily, I mean, it's got to be a combination, obviously, of like food availability, how much forage they have, and also, you know, being cool enough to sustain them and keep them alive. Do you tend to see them kind of push from those lower stretches, and then as it gets hotter, push way up into the headwaters, kind of near the closer to the spring head, sort of, or do they just kind of go as far up as they need to, and that's about it?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's one I'm not sure what the answer is to, and it's kind of one we're planning. Well, it is one we're planning on looking into this coming spring. We're actually putting tags, VHF tags, radio tags, and about 20, 25 big brown trout that we're going to sample on one of the larger lower ends of the larger system in spring, and kind of see where they're going, you know, because the question is like, are they contributing to the fisheries and the way headwaters, or are they just scooting up a little bit and finding these little cold water inflows and maybe still just hanging out, you know, nearby, or are they making big movements? So
sure.
Yeah, that's a good question, and one I'm curious about myself. It could kind of inform, you know, like, hey, you know, these lower areas, if, you know, these fish are moving up, contributing to these really popular fisheries way upstream, well, you know, maybe these lower areas are actually pretty important to produce those big fish. So maybe we should do, you know, easement purchases or habitat work or whatever, you know. So, yeah, it'll be curious to see what that reveals. I'm kind of, should be fun. Our tags, too, that we're getting, they send back, you know, it's kind of your standard, you know, like if you've seen tracking studies with like wolves and elk and whatnot, you know, where they got the antenna, it's the same sort of thing. But these tags will also be sending back temperature information. So it'll be really interesting to see what conditions the fish are experiencing versus, you know, the overall. So are they finding these little areas where it's colder in these overall warmer systems, you know? So yeah, it should be fun.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Oh, is that going to be, that'll have to be a published study, right? That's going to be the coolest thing ever. I can't wait for that. That's awesome. Dang. So when you say contribute to the fishery, like these bigger fish, do you mean like they're going all the way up to spawn and do that sort of thing, like contributing that way? Or if they're just chilling, they're not just hanging out in the back and getting fat. They're actually actively participating in the population, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, both bringing their, you know, dropping their eggs and up there in the headwaters and contributing to the fishery that way. But also, like, you know, like I said before, we occasionally see these big brown trout in the upper reaches where otherwise you've got a mostly kind of medium size structure population. You know, you maybe get a 14, 15, but every once in a while you get this 20 incher. Is that, you know, is that fish actually a fish that's spending a portion of its time downriver? Or is that a fish that's just somehow finding a way to get big in these systems, these higher density systems where the average maximum size is smaller? So,
sure. That's been a working theory of mine as well. It's like, do these fish just find a spot that they figured out? Like, I get all the food I need here. This temperature stay fairly consistent. I have enough shade and cover that I can tuck up under this undercut or whatever it may be. And I just live in this, you know, whatever it may be, whether it be a 50-yard stretch or, you know, this bend or whatever. Because we did, with a couple clients last year, catch the same fish more than once. And I was like super excited because I was like, huh, sweet. Like this is like same, like he ate it about 10 feet further back the last time. So that's kind of cool that he did the same thing. Have you guys shocked any of the same fish more than once in your studies?
We definitely have. So on our trend surveys, we tag about 25 fish at each of our sites. So we do, 3 to 5 sites per trend stream. And what do we do? Like 6 or 7 trend streams. So we put out quite a few tags, and these are pit tags. They're kind of like about the size of a grain of rice. We use a needle to put the tag and kind of near its pelvic fin. And then same thing as like those tags that you get in your dog, you know, you scan it with a wand, you get the specific ID and stuff. But anyway, yeah, to answer your question, yeah, we've seen, you know, in those trend reaches, it's pretty interesting. It seems like based on our pit tags that and our returns where we get those, that the brown trout we're sampling and resampling, you know, recapturing are kind of living in a pretty small area. So like on one of our sites, we pretty much get all of our tags out in the first 50 meters because we get so many fish. Sure. And in years that we've followed up and, you know, resampled in the following summer, year after year, it seems like all of the recaptures that we get, even though we do a 150 meter long stretch, all those recaptures are in the first 50 meters. So it's like some of these fish just really like the place where they're living, I guess. But yeah, otherwise we've handled fish, you know, up to four or five times. And it's pretty interesting, you know, like the variation in growth and size. I imagine it's probably like sex specific with like, you know, males typically, like you see in other fish populations too, males, you know, maybe maturing a little bit earlier and then just kind of leveling out, and maybe some females growing a little bit larger, quicker. But at any rate, yeah. So maybe there's just variation too in terms of like, you know, prey availability and dominance hierarchies too, because, you know, trout within pools, they have these dominance hierarchies where, you know, one fish can kind of dominate the most optimal spot where it gets the most food with the least amount of work. So you can imagine growth might be way faster in that fish than the others. But anyway, so we've got some fish where like, you know, they might just top out at like 12 inches, you know, and that's basically where they're at. And we've had fish, you know, like where we even recapture them the following year, they're the same length at like 12.5 or something, you know?
Sure.
And then others where it's like, you know, they're 1 year, they're going, you know, 16 to seven, they grew like an inch between 16 and 17, you know, inches. And yeah. So it, yeah, the tagging stuff is really, really been interesting and kind of useful. Yeah,
that's fascinating. There's not just like a steady growth rate for any of these fish. It's totally dependent on what their, I guess, demeanor is like in the pool. That's fascinating. Yeah. I love that. I imagine those are the those are the fish that we see with a bunch of little like pink spots on their lips. And that's super cool, man. So on the note then of shocking streams, where their fish are sitting and everything, what's the most surprising spot that you've, not like a geographic pin, but like where's the spot, like something where you've been shocking a stream and you've been like, how did that fish come out of there? Or like, I would not have expected, I'm sure at this point you're like, yep, should be one there, should be one there, should be one there. But what's the most surprising spot they've come from?
Yeah, I mean, some of the super, super tiny water always astounds me, like what can be in there. So, I mean, it's like you might have a flow where it's just a trickle. It's less than a CFS. And there's these little riffles, like getting some YOIs and all, you know, and then there's a pool, you know, and it's like, okay, you know, maybe we see a couple adults and it's like some giant 18-incher is in this tiny little stream. It's like, he must just be living in that pool, you know, because like his back would be sticking out of the water if he swam up the riffles, you know. So, yeah, some of those tiny streams are impressive. Like, you know, they're just, they're fine in there. It's good enough for them to live and grow. And so they're there. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, just trying to think anything else is really, but yeah, that's probably the biggest one.
Sure. I like that. That's super cool. How many more fish in general, you talked about just like the shocking densities that you've seen over your time electrofishing and everything. Like, how many more fish typically are tucked up under that undercut than people think that they just like walk over or anything? Because like I've stuck my leg back under those a couple times trying to retrieve flies or whatever it may be, and like gone up to my hip and not been able to touch the back of it and just been astounded by how deep those undercuts go. Like,
I mean, it's well, you know, electrofishing, I think what happens is a lot of times too is they kind of, you push them into those areas, so we really do get them out of those undercuts, you know. So like when we're electrofishing, where we get the fish might not necessarily be the exact spot where they were, okay, you know, hanging sure out.
Yeah, it makes
but
sense.
They, yeah, when we hit, like, if there's a big undercut in a productive stream, gosh, we might be, you know, I think people would be stunned. We've got a few, you know, GoPro videos on our really productive waters where it's like, we're just sitting there, you know, just sitting there on this one undercut for 5 minutes, just dipping. Mm-hmm. Oh, passing fish. My arm is sore. You know, like our tub is getting over full of brown trout. We got somebody in the back putting water in there, you know, trying to keep it more water than fish, you know? So mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, it can be silly, the numbers in some of these
no
where
kidding.
It's just, yeah. They're not all like that, but the most productive ones are just, yeah, it's like, how is it possible that this amount of water could produce this much fish biomass, you know? So,
right.
I've been impressed for sure, shocked even when we do them, but yeah.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about tiger trout.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Have you guys seen any population trends with them? Like, I've heard it's like the 1 in 1,000 mm-hmm. typically or whatever. Is that accurate? Do you think it's higher, lower? What have you seen?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say tigers are maybe even less, you know, less common than that, at least in mm-hmm. our four counties. Of course, it depends on the stream.
Sure.
Some streams are going to have more of them, but they're, yeah, maybe 1 in 2,000. We see, you know, typically a couple a year, and we're handling, it might even be lower than 1 in 2,000 now that I think about it, because we handle a lot of fish and we only see a couple each year, I'd say. So it's hard to tell in terms of trends where, you know, because we see so few. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it seems to be where I've seen them is kind of those areas where, well, you got a mix of brook and browns, and maybe it's transitioning to more browns, because we've seen brown trout push up into some brook trout water and on sure. some of our streams. And in those areas, it seems like there's a better chance of seeing some tigers. Yeah. In terms of trends, it's hard to say because we see so few. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're always a treat to see when we get to see them. I mean, they're pretty cool looking for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Definitely. I went on a hot streak. Took me like 9 years to catch my first one. And then I caught three in like a 7 month span after nice. That. And I was like, well, I'm not going to catch one again until I'm 50. Like yeah. this sucks.
yeah.
That's yeah. funny, man. Well, dude, we're coming up over an hour here. So I want to make sure you're able to get back to your day and everything here. But for folks listening here, before we wrap up, we got a couple of final questions for you here. Mm-hmm. First question, what advice do you have for someone who's never fished the Driftless region?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think a big thing is kind of getting a feel for the lay of the land. So if you can take a peek at some maps before you come here, I mean, there's so much water. And if you might ask somebody and they might just direct you to a couple of streams that are going to be really, mm-hmm. you know, there's going to be probably a lot of anglers on those more popular waters. Just take a peek at a map, you know, so like the DNR, if you Google DNR fishing finder, we've got a ArcGIS map that shows where easements and classified trout waters are. And you can kind of get a feel based on where our easements are located. If we bought an easement there, that's probably a spot you want to know. We bought it because the fishing's good, you know, so it's mm-hmm. it's worth investigating. But yeah, just getting a feel for the lay of the land. But yeah, it's always worth reaching out to guides and reaching out to your local fly shop. Just to see, you know, kind of what's going on, what to try. But yeah, I mean, otherwise, just general advice for somebody visiting, you know, another thing to consider is just try to be courteous of other anglers too. I mean, I think, you know, as we've seen a good amount of pressure on our streams and certainly increasing on some streams, like, you know, with all the classified trout water we have, if you see somebody parked at a bridge, you can probably just drive a little ways and find a bridge and a section of stream all to yourself. So mm-hmm. that's kind of the beauty of this area too, is 95% of the time you're not fishing with anyone else, you know, up or down stream. Yeah, you're on your own in a little section of stream, and because there's so much water, you can spread out. So I think be courteous in that regard. Also be courteous to the landowners. So you might see, you know, there's a cattle fence or, you know, make sure you get your car all the way off the roads because, you know, like I've had farmers complain where they're trying to get their harvester or whatever across this tiny bridge and somebody's too far out into the lane. So just be, just, you know, slow down. Don't go zipping around. Be courteous. I think all those things are good things too. But yeah, otherwise just, just get a feel for the lay of land before you come. Reach out to folks. Yeah, feel free to email me too. I'm happy to give you some pointers. But
awesome. Yeah, and I mean one of the things you've said it a couple of times here too, just on the restoration front and the easemented stretches. Like the work you guys are doing is super intentional in how can we make this the best possible resource for the fish, but also for the anglers, so that they're not sitting here fighting that one tree that's got every branch under 10 feet snapped off and the top three look like Charlie Brown's Christmas tree and all that. Like we've all been there and it's, you know, it's good to know that like you guys are doing that intentionally and that you guys are, you know, people just need to keep that in mind that the DNR is always doing things to make things better. They're not trying to inhibit really anything unless it's for the protection of a resource. Right.
So, right. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well said. we're here to make fishing better. You know, I mean, our funding, you know, my terms of my funding, a lot of it comes from, you know, taxes on fishing equipment and license sales. And so, you know, we're here serving anglers and trying to do the best for the resource and the anglers. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. You kind of touched on it too, but on the angler side of things, what can anglers do to, you know, increase, to make your job easier basically and for like the betterment of our trout streams? What would you suggest?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing you can pat yourself on the back right away just by being an angler legally and purchasing your license and your trout stamp and your fishing gear, you are contributing to conservation. So it's kind of the, you know, nice thing about the way things are set up. Year in Wisconsin is and North America is, you know, you're contributing to conservation just by fishing. So, you know, those fees help pay for the habitat work and the monitoring and all the stuff that we do. On top of that, I think, you know, finding if you're an avid angler and you want to try to, you know, give back, contribute positively to the resource, you know, reach out to, you know, your local Trout Unlimited chapter or other, you know, groups that you think, you know, that are doing work to help, you know, conserve the resource. And they often have field days, you know, doing streamside brushing or tree planting, all those sorts of things. I think there's usually opportunities there for that.
Excellent. And if you're somebody who's interested in Doug Dern's Sharing the Land initiative, that's a great way to build out the conservation resume if you're looking to do stuff like that. But another thing too that I'll add to that is, you know, we touched on earlier that like Knowles Nelson is used to fund a lot of these stream bank easements and a lot of the purchasing of these lands that you guys are able to go and do that. We know that it's kind of stalled out, but there is still time to contact your state representative and give him a friendly nudge that you would like to see Knowles Nelson continue and or at least be revived here to make these projects continue on to be possible and so on and so forth. Because we talked about it on the waterfowl front, we talked about it on the public lands front, the boat ramps front, but stream bank easements are an absolute lifesaver and make everybody's time, like you said, like having the option to, like we are so spoiled to not be in a state where the stream bed is privately owned, you know, and to have the luxury of being able to go down such and such valley, see two cars or three cars and jump over the next ridge and have the whole place to ourselves. Like that's what makes the Driftless so cool and so fun is the fact that it could be your next favorite spot could literally be around the next corner and you'd have no idea until you go out and explore. It's a special place. But Kirk, I really appreciate your time, man. Where can folks go to learn more about Wisconsin's trout streams, check out the regulations, and also get in touch with you and learn more about some of the work that you guys are doing?
Yeah. Couple different resources. You could just simply search, you know, Wisconsin DNR trout fishing regulations, and you'll get a nice map of where their trout regs are. Otherwise, there's the online mapping tool I mentioned. You search for the Wisconsin Fishing Finder. That's got some easement locations and some habitat work locations, that sort of thing. Nice tool. But yeah, otherwise, an underutilized resource that we have too is our trout fisheries reports. So if you search Wisconsin DNR trout fisheries reports, there's a big page with a long list of trout reports, and it goes by county. And in some of those, we really go into detail, and there's lots of great information in those for those who are, really curious and want to learn more.
I've spent many an evening poring over those fisheries reports.
There's some great stuff in there.
Sometimes it's almost like, wow, like, surprised this is public, but as an angler, I feel that way. Holy smokes, there's a lot of answers in there for those who are willing to go look for them. So folks, I'll leave it at that. But Kirk, I appreciate the heck out of your time and all that you're doing to protect our trout streams and fisheries, and just all the work that you and your team do to make them continue on to be such a special place and the special resource they have that we have here in Wisconsin, man. I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to hopefully having you back on as we get that that pit tagging survey and get a little more data on that, because I'm fired up about that. But seriously, man, I really appreciate it, and I look forward to chatting further down the road.
Awesome. It's been great to talk to you, and it's always a pleasure to talk about the resource here. It's something special for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And folks, the weather's just getting better, so find some time to go get out on the trout streams and explore everything that we've been chatting about here today. You will not regret it. But with that, folks, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next Tuesday. Thanks, Kirk.
Thanks.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, Lone Wolf Custom Gear, Onyx Hunt, Huntworth Gear, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands that support this show. And if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other awesome outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.